Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, and I'm your host, Richard Wolff. We try every week to bring you information about the economic aspects of our lives, what's happening to our jobs, our incomes, the prices we pay, all of that. I've been a professor of economics all my life. That's where I acquired whatever knowledge I have to convey. I currently teach in the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for truthout.org, a courageous, independent source of news and analysis daily. Check them out at truthout.org. Please also remember that we have two websites that provide all kinds of additional information, links, and sources of where we get the news that we analyze here. Please visit them at your convenience, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Through these websites, you can contact us directly to provide us with your suggestions, criticisms, questions for us to answer. And you can also connect to us and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And we urge you to please do that. Finally, please bear with us because we get a flood of emails. We cannot answer them all. And we are asking your indulgence that we have to pick a few. And it's not out of disrespect. We read all of them and we try to shape the program accordingly. I'm going to talk a little faster on this program because we have so much material that it's just too frustrating to talk at my normal speed because we can't get to it all. I want to also respond to some of your questions because I use the word listener and viewer. So I'm proud to let you know that we are now on television, a televised version of this program, in Manhattan, in New York City, every Tuesday p.m. at 8 o'clock. On the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34. I want to start today's updates, our short ones that open every program, by letting you know of the remarkable new mayor of the capital of the state of Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, that state's largest city, as well as its capital, last May of 2013, elected Chokwe Lumumba its new mayor. And this is not your normal mayor. And given what this program talks about, I wanted to read you a short quotation of Mayor Lumumba given to an interviewer in San Francisco shortly after he was elected last year. Quote, "We have to make sure that economically we're free, and part of that is the whole idea of economic democracy. We have to deal with more cooperative thinking and more involvement of people in the control of businesses, as opposed to just the big money changers or the big CEOs and the big multinational corporations, the big capitalist corporations which generally control here in Mississippi." And just to make himself clear, he also announced later, together with many others, a new economies conference set to take place in Jackson, Mississippi, in May of this year, May 2nd to be precise, in Jackson, Mississippi, gathering all kinds of people interested in worker co-ops and other ways for people to become controllers of the businesses upon which we all depend. Interesting developments in a place you might not have expected them to come from. The new government of Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi. And the same thing is reportable from Europe. There, in the city of Marseille in France, in the south of France, right on the Mediterranean, there's been a conference just last week to deal with and to celebrate the FRALIB, F-R-A-L-I-B Corporation, 80 workers, producing all kinds of herbs and products derived from herbs, which grow beautifully in that part of France. These 80 workers, when they couldn't work out a deal with their employers, basically took over the enterprise, employers didn't want it anymore, and it's now run as a workers' co-op. And so successful has it been that they decided to have a conference this last week, drawing people from all over Europe who are doing likewise in various parts of Europe and occupying factories. Brazil and Mexico were represented, among others, where this is happening. So it's a remarkable turn of events in as diverse places as Jackson, Mississippi, and Marseille, France. The next economic update that I would like to bring to your attention has to do with a complicated scandal that spread across the United States over the last several weeks. This has to do with computer hackers breaking into the computers of huge corporations, in this case, three in the United States, the Target, or Target, if you like, department chain, Neiman Marcus, an upscale department chain, and the Michaels stores across the United States. Huge numbers, millions and millions of people's personal information, their credit card numbers, their bank accounts, and so on, were hacked into and have already been used to commit all kinds of theft and fraud. So we looked into this a little more, and we figured out what is now becoming public, that the United States is behind the rest of the world, particularly Europe and other parts of the world, in its computer credit card technology. Here's the basic problem. We use something called MagStripe. It's a little stripe on the back of your credit card, I'm sure you've noticed it, which basically contains all of the relevant information about you that the banks and so forth use to process your accounts when you use a credit card. In Europe, and I've known this for years having traveled there, credit cards are different. In Europe, there's a chip embedded in the card, and when you use the card, that chip talks to the computer and the machines that use the card, but you also have to manually input a 4-digit PIN code. The card alone and the information on it, which is much more difficult for anyone to get, is by itself insufficient. Without that PIN code entered by you when you use the card is useless, and nobody but you, presumably, knows what those 4 digits are. Here's the problem. The United States is the place where about 25% of credit card usage occurs. But we are also the country in which 44% of all the fraud done with those credit cards happens. In other words, we are much more fraud vulnerable than other parts of the world. So why haven't we, in the United States, used the credit card technology that they have used and that has saved them from having these kinds of horrific scandals, hacked information, but also fraud in all the different ways? Turns out the answer is that the credit card companies didn't want to spend the money, it's expensive, to change the technology from the old, vulnerable to theft technology that they've been using to the new, more modern, more advanced, more safe technology. Only this last scandal of the last few weeks, when computer hackers put thousands of Americans into great difficulty when their cards were hacked, when their numbers were illegally and fraudulently used. Now they're finally discovering what, of course, everyone knew. Why do I bring this to your attention? To embarrass those corporations? No. But to learn a lesson again. When people tell you that big private capitalist enterprises are the ones we need to have because they always keep us at the cutting edge of new technology, here's an example to remind us that that's simply not true. The big credit card companies and the banks they work with kept an old, backward technology. They knew to be that way. They knew these statistics. They kept it for years until a scandal hurting huge numbers of Americans forced them now to admit that they have to do some catch-up with the technology that has been around for quite a while. Next update. This one is drawn from Consumer Reports magazine, but it was important enough that I thought it should be brought to our attention, and we can make some comments about it. This has to do with the way producers of chicken that we buy in the supermarket, raw chicken, how they label those chickens. What do those labels mean, and what can we learn from the process? And I'm just going to go through some, not all of the labels. If you are interested in the whole details, please take a look at the February 2014 issue of Consumer Reports, where you'll get the full dope on all of this. So first, a label says no hormones. This label is pointless, as Consumer Reports points out, because the law in the United States prevents any chicken producer anywhere ever from using hormones. So when a company tells you they have no hormones in their chickens, that doesn't distinguish them from any other chickens. It's a pointless, meaningless way of advertising and getting you to buy. Next label, cage-free. Also meaningless, says Consumer Reports, because no chickens raised for meat are kept in cages. That's only chickens that are raised for eggs. Next, natural. Their Consumer Reports gives its full humorous comment. Utterly meaningless. Free range. Their Consumer Reports points out there is no definition of what that means. There's no definition of how long a chicken is outdoors, if at all. What outdoors exactly means. What the size of the outdoor place is. Whether it's a concrete outdoors, etc., etc. No definition of free range. And finally, pasture raised. There's no definition of that either. If you really want to be sure your chicken has been out and about rather than cooped up, then you need to look for a label called animal welfare approved, which is very, very scarce in the United States. What's the lesson here? Businesses, private enterprises, seek to get you to buy what they produce. In the lore of capitalism, we are supposed to be told that the producers only produce what people want. What this discussion of chicken labeling shows us is that the producers are not so passive. They make sure that we want what they can profitably produce. And they don't stop at using every kind of word labeling to promote their product, even when those words and labeling are clearly misleading and designed basically to fool us by giving us labels which Consumer Reports teaches us are utterly meaningless. Finally, here's a story that also teaches us something about our capitalist system that we would find disgusting if we read it in any other context. This has to do with telephone calls made by inmates in prisons of the United States. As you know, because we've reported on it on this program, the United States has the dubious distinction of having the highest percentage of its population incarcerated of any country in the world, and certainly any advanced industrial country. A scandal all of its own. But I just want to talk about a small detail. All of the people we put in jail have certain rights. And one of them is to communicate by telephone from their cells, from their prisons, to their families and their friends and their spouses and so on. So the question is, how exactly is that arranged? Well, in the United States, private companies, and one in particular, Global Tel Link, contract with prisons to provide that service. In other words, they pay various kinds of fees to prisons in order to be able to set up the telephone linkages that are then made available to prisoners to call their families. And herein lies a scandal. And this scandal was very nicely revealed in the New York Times, Sunday, February 2nd, in something called the Hagler column. And there you can find many more details than I have the time for here. But suffice it to say, here are some examples. Global Tel Link charging 70 cents a minute, if you work it out, for calls. in the United States these days, a basic telephone call costs between 1 and 2 cents a minute, if that. They charge 70 cents. Often they require that a prisoner set up an account. In the example of the New York Times, Global Tellink charged $9.50 fee to allow a prisoner to set up a $50 account from which to deduct the cost of the telephone calls that prisoner made. The Federal Communications Commission, thankfully, is passing a rule that takes effect this month, February 2014, to limit the interstate call charges to prisoners to 21 to 25 cents a minute, still an enormously high cost. And this makes me wonder what proportion of telephone calls are interstate. Turns out only about 20%. 80% of calls prisoners make are to their family and friends inside the same state where they are in prison. They're not covered by this rule. So then I looked, finally, and give me an example of where there's a state that charges reasonably. Turns out it's the state of New York. In the state of New York, there's a maximum for interstate and intrastate calls prisoners make, 4.8 cents a minute. And guess who has the contract in New York State for that rate and makes profit from it? You got it. Global Tellink. If they can make it in New York on 4.8%, if that's a contract they want to have and do have, then imagine the profits being gouged out of prisoners and their families in all the other states where all those other high prices are charged. Again, an example of free enterprise in action, cutting a deal with the government, and you know who is at the short end of that operation. Okay, it is time to turn to the more substantial subjects, which take a longer conversation than our shorter opening updates. So let's turn to them. This one is one that I want to begin by thanking a young man, Michael Palmieri, who did the research and making it possible for me to make this analysis for you who are listening and watching. And he's a young fellow in the New School University in New York, and I want to publicly thank him for this work. And here's what I learned from his research. Many people believe that for the last 25 years, we've been living under a drumbeat in which we've been told that anything done by the government is inefficient, wasteful, and ineffective, whereas anything taken over by the private sector, by a private enterprise driven by the rules of the market, will be more efficient, cheaper in the long run, better for everybody. Okay, is this true? Simple answer, not even close. Is it even true that we don't have large parts of our economy that not only haven't gone private, but have steadfastly remained public? And that the people who benefit from them have kept them public? And the answer is yes. And before I tell you some of the details, which are very interesting and very important, I wanted to also tell you that when I'm done, I'm going to show you that in fact the pendulum has swung, and that what's going on in the last 10 years is a swing from public, from private to public, not the way the ideologues of the last 25 years have told us, but quite the opposite, that more and more communities are going back to public enterprise because they're not happy with the results of private enterprise. But first, the realities. And particularly, I'm going to use examples from the United States where this drumbeat of the private is better and more efficient than the public has been the loudest, probably in the whole world. Okay, I'm going to start with electric energy production. Is electric energy, electricity effectively, something that the private sector dominates, controls, and has proven to be the most effective way to go? Not at all. Basically, One quarter of the electricity flowing into the homes and businesses in this country are not produced by private enterprises. They're either produced by public enterprises run by cities and states, or they're produced cooperatively by co-ops, by cooperatives that include the workers as a co-op and the consumers of the electricity also as a co-op. So roughly 75% of electricity generated and transmitted by private enterprises, about 12.5% by cities and states, and a final 12.5% by co-ops, local, regional, private co-ops of the producers and transmitters on the one hand and the consumers on the other. And here's perhaps the most important fact. For residential consumers across America, if you get your electricity from a private enterprise capitalist, you pay 14% more for your electricity on average than if you get it from a public or a cooperative enterprise. That's right. The public and cooperative enterprises deliver electricity significantly cheaper to their customer base than do the private capitalists. And it's also cheaper for stores, commercial enterprises. They also have a saving if they buy from a public or a co-op rather than private enterprise. Only for industries, for the big consumers, is it about the same, slightly better for the private enterprise than for the public, but that's probably because the private enterprises buy big chunks of electricity from private enterprises rather than from the public. So the advantage isn't. And let me give you what it's claimed to be. And let me give you an example of a couple of places, actually three here in the United States, that have proudly insisted never to go private because they don't believe in it. First, the Los Angeles, California Department of Water and Power. They have been going for over 100 years as a public municipal utility, with a huge customer base of 1.5 million people who've kept it that way. They like it that way. Thank you very much. In fact, they're the second biggest after the Power Authority in Puerto Rico, which is also a public producer and distributor of electricity on the island there. Another example, the Power Authority of the State of New York, created in the Depression, 1931, like many public utility companies, has been publicly producing power, transmissions particularly of power, for all these years since 1931. And over that time, the surplus, the profits that company earned, that public company, over $1 billion, was given back to the state of New York, allowing the state of New York to tax its people $1 billion less, because that money was coming in from the public production of power. So the notion that we only have a private system isn't true. The notion that public is less efficient than private isn't true. And these are concrete examples that prove it. And most interestingly now is that over the last 10 years particularly, there's been a growing movement back to take advantage of these very facts to public production of energy, public production of water services, and so on. This stuff used to be called municipal socialism. That is, when the public sector took over from the private sector. I don't think that really has much to do with socialism. It has to do with whether the public or the private runs an enterprise. It doesn't tell you much about how the enterprise is actually run, and it doesn't tell you whether the workers in that enterprise have any more say when they're run by a private company as opposed to being employed by a public agency. But it is interesting in its own right because it contradicts the kind of fundamentalism we've been taught that somehow private is always more efficient or beneficial than public. In the International Review of Applied Economics, particularly in an issue 27, number 2, in 2013, an article called Remunicipalization in the Early 21st Century, Water in France and Energy in Germany, is a profound article. I won't bore you with the details. Basically, they show very effectively that over the last 10 years, many, many water companies in France and many, many electricity companies in Germany lost their contracts to provide cities and regions with water and electricity because the price was too high and the consumers were dissatisfied with the high price and the low quality. And they reverted back to public provision of these services, having a public company and or a cooperative do it. France had this, Germany. But when I began to look into it, with the help of Michael Palmieri, I learned that Hungary, Italy, Spain, and many other countries, Argentina, China, Colombia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the United States, are also going in this direction. That's right. Converting from private enterprise to public because it works better. Wow. So let me conclude by giving you a list of some of the places in the United States that over the last 10 years have canceled their contracts or terminated their contracts with private providers of water, electricity, or other utilities and converted back to public because it was cheaper, more efficient, more equitable, more controllable in the interests of the population. Ready? They might surprise you. Atlanta, Georgia. Houston, Texas. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Gary and Indianapolis in Indiana. Isn't that remarkable? The whole story of public versus private bounced around on its head. But before I leave the topic, one last thought. For me, as for many others, this was never a serious issue. Private enterprises, run by a few boards of director folks, major shareholders, are constantly putting their own interests as shareholders, their own interests as executives, ahead of those of their own employees and ahead of those of the communities they serve. The examples of that are so numerous that you'd have to be very ideologically blinded not to recognize it. But it is also true and possible that public companies run by a handful of officials of the government have also displayed, on occasion, the ability to disregard the needs of their employees and the needs of the public they're supposed to serve. So I'm not surprised that when a private company gets a contract, it can pretty soon overcharge and badly treat its people. And I'm not surprised when the state takes over that after a few years, the same thing happens. So I'm not surprised that it oscillates back and forth. Public to private, private to public. I don't want to hear another argument about one of them is always better than the other, because that's never been true, and the story I've just told you reconfirms it yet again. What I'd rather see is a real alternative. Put utilities in the hands of a combination of the workers who work there and the communities that are served. Let them be run together that way. That gives us a better chance to make sure that in the provision of public utilities, the consumer is served and the worker is served. Do not create a layer of officials or a layer of major shareholders and boards of directors to get in the way of making our economic resources serve our people. Let me just open the second major topic we're going to deal with, and then we'll take our usual mid-program break. I want to talk to you yet again about bankers and banking. You know, I've concentrated most of our discussions of bankers and banking over the last many months on the endless scandal of the major commercial banks here in the United States and indeed in other countries. Over the last 2 or 3 years, they have paid record fines, many billions of dollars, for the following short list, not a complete one, of the things they have done that have been either illegal or unethical or both. Laundering criminal money for criminals trying to make sure they can escape detection. Number two, having a lot to do with bringing the mortgage crisis that has crippled the housing industries of Europe, America, and many other parts of the world. Manipulating global interest rates, the so-called LIBOR scandal concentrated in London. Overcharging for all kinds of fees and services to recoup their losses in the crisis of the last 7 years. And finally, the current investigation into manipulation of foreign exchange banking activities. This is a private banking sector that has lost the confidence of the public and that should have lost any toleration for keeping banking in the hands of people who have abused that position so badly. When we return after our short break, I'm going to talk to you about a couple of new, interesting ways to do better in the realm of banking than leaving it in the hands of large private banks who have lost the right to continue in that business. Thank you very much. I'll be back with you in a very few minutes.
I guess I just must be a daredevil. I don't feel anything until I smash it up. I'm caught on the cold, caught on the hot. Not so with the warmer lot. And all I want's a confidant to help me laugh it off. And don't let me ruin me. I got from my heartbreak. Make the slots and the flaps upon my wing, and I use them to give me lift. Hip, hip for the lift. Hip, hip for the drag. I want them all in my bag. Oh, give me anything, and I'll turn it into a gift.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to welcome you to a continuation of the conversation we were having and the analysis we were offering. This time of the banking problems, particularly in the United States. But these arguments you're going to hear have a resonance and an applicability all over the world. I won't repeat what we said before the break, which has to do with the illegal and unethical and very costly activities of our huge global banks. I want to talk instead about how else banking might be handled, particularly for consumers. And I'm going to again use the United States, but this is applicable elsewhere. One option, one alternative that we have talked about and that I will talk about again in the future has been credit unions. They have a very good history of being attentive to the needs of people, of not taking undue risks, of being less concerned about the profits because there are kinds of cooperatives, after all. And so they represent an alternative currently hemmed in by all kinds of laws that the banks have put in there to limit the ability of credit unions to compete with private banking. But that's not what I'm going to concentrate on today. Nor am I going to concentrate on public banking of the sort we have and that I've spoken about, namely the Bank of North Dakota, a bank set up by that state as a public institution, and that has existed there for many, many decades because it's demanded and supported by the folks in North Dakota. No, I want to draw your attention to a recent report, January of 2014, from the United States Postal Service that can be another way to do banking far better than huge private banking corporations are now doing it, particularly what we call consumer banking, the part of banking business that deals with the mass of people's basic needs. And here I want to draw your attention to a report of the Inspector General of the United States Postal Service, issued on the 27th of January, 2014. The report is called Providing Non-Bank Financial Services for the Underserved. Here's the basic idea. Something near 70 million people, so you're talking, you know, almost a fifth or over a fifth of the American population, are underserved. These are people who either have no bank account or are required by their lives and their incomes to rely on payday loans and very, very expensive services provided to them, if they can even get them, in their neighborhoods by banks and by credit companies of various sorts. And the post office has come up with an idea. Why not use the post office as a way to provide the underserved, who spend tens of billions of dollars a year on these services, an average of $2,400 a family, and we're talking mostly people who don't have much income, so they're spending a fortune on credit services of various kinds that are provided by bankers and finance companies that gouge them. The post office could be an alternative. The post office could provide a place to deposit your money. It could provide you with credit cards. It could provide you with bill paying services, money orders, small loans, mobile transactions, international transfers. We have many immigrants in the United States who have to spend a fortune to send money back to their families. The post office could and should be doing all of this. My listeners in the United States might be interested to know that in many, many, many other countries, the post office already does all of these things. And here's what it does. It provides the underserved with good quality service at a low price. It provides what the big banks don't, or what they overcharge for. If the post office did it, it would be a healthy competition for the private sector. See whether they could meet or match it, just like we spoke about with water or electricity a few minutes ago. Wow. It turns out in other countries, providing these services brings a huge revenue stream to their postal system. And it would do that here in the United States. No minor matter, because we keep cutting postal services, claiming that the post office doesn't have the money to continue them. We're even discussing cutting Saturday delivery and so on. Here's a way to improve the finances of the post office and do something for the people who need it most here in the United States with no additional tax dollars spent. Here's another thought. There won't be any big cost here. You don't have to build these banks because the post offices would work as banks. That's how it works in other countries. The post office is already there in every community, able to help people in rich and poor communities alike, if they need and want quality service provided in a place they visit anyway as the local post office, but that can now do much more with those existing spaces and those existing computers and those existing personnel. Aha! Aha! Maybe a way to do something that the big banks will have to sit up and take notice. And let's suppose the big banks lose some business. Well, that's a wake-up call, isn't it? And who deserves it most? And who deserves it more? The big banks, whose behavior has meant this is the least of what should befall them, given how they have served or misserved the public. Our final longer discussion for today has to do with a book. I don't do that very often, but a book has crossed my desk that I'd like to bring to your attention and that I would also like to discuss a little bit because I think you'll find it interesting. The book is called Capital in the 21st Century. The author is Thomas Piketty. P as in Peter, I-K-E-T-T-Y. Thomas Piketty. Book is published in 2014 by the Harvard University Press. Thomas Piketty is famous because he has worked together with Emmanuel Saez, and the two of them, Saez and Piketty, are probably the most well-known specialists in analyzing the distribution of wealth and income across the world over the last 20 years. These are the experts. Their statistical work is used by almost everybody to understand the growing inequality of wealth and income around the world. People from all persuasions use their work. And Thomas Piketty is a French economist in Paris. Emmanuel Saez is a professor of economics at the University of California in Berkeley. So Mr. Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, makes the following basic point. The way capitalism is organized, he says, and he's looked at many countries over several centuries, capitalist system, he says, tends to produce unequal distributions of wealth and income, and indeed, over time, to make the distribution of wealth and income increasingly unequal. This is going to upset all kinds of folks, but his numbers are stunning and his argument pretty airtight. He then makes the following comment. What happened across the middle of the 20th century, roughly from the 1930s to roughly the 1970s, that actually seems to buck this trend? Seems to be a period of time when the distribution of wealth and income didn't become more unequal, rather the opposite. It became more equal, at least roughly for those 40 years. Mr. Piketty notes that. His statistics show it too. And his analysis goes as follows. It is possible, he said, for political forces, political parties, political movements, to change the outcome that capitalism, left to itself, tends to produce. In other words, people can intervene using the political system to change the results of capitalism, making capitalism less unequal than it would otherwise be. But the implication here is that only if and when political forces, masses of people in a political movement, masses of people voting for political parties and candidates, only when that happens, and there's a direct intervention for that purpose, will capitalism yield less inequality rather than more? Will we get the unusual in capitalism, which is relative equality, versus what capitalism left to itself tends to produce, which Piketty shows to be deepening inequality? Now let me make a comment. I think the analysis is excellent. I think the statistics are clear. I think the message, as far as it goes, is right on target. It has been political interventions. Here in the United States, the upsurge of the labor movement, socialist and communist parties in the United States in the 1930s, who got Social Security passed then, unemployment compensation, public hiring of people, all of those things achieved in the 30s radically altered the distribution of income, as did the raising of taxes on rich individuals and corporations relative to middle and lower income individuals. All those things were profound political interventions, and that made the United States much less unequal after the 1930s than it had been before. After the 1970s, much of that kind of political intervention was either reduced or stopped or even reversed. That's what the Reagan Revolution meant here. That's what the Thatcher Revolution meant in Britain, and so on. And so once again, after the 70s, the tendency of capitalism to ever greater inequality resumed. But here's the problem with Mr. Piketty. He's right that political intervention can make a difference. What he doesn't seem to want to face is that the people who benefit from an unequal capitalism, the 1%, the 5% at the top, those who control the corporations, and those who earn the really rich income, They understand Mr. Piketty's research, too. They also have noticed that the political intervention of masses of people, as it occurred in the United States in the 30s, can, in fact, undo some of capitalism's inequality. And they've reacted to that insight. That's why money controls politics so utterly in the United States, even more than in the past. Because those who earn the big bucks, those who benefit from growing inequality, they've learned they better control the political system, or else you can get the kinds of interventions that Mr. Piketty's research shows is the only way within capitalism to undo its tendency towards ever worse inequality. The lessons of that for Americans thinking and worrying about inequality should be relatively obvious. Let me return, as I always do towards the end of these programs, to responding to your comments, questions, and criticisms. Many of you have written to me and asked me to comment on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the effort of about a dozen nations, all of whom are on the Pacific Ocean, to cut a deal allowing the corporations inside them to move freely among these 12 countries to avoid all kinds of legal limits that these countries try to put on corporations, to get a free range to do what's profitable for them. That's what they want, and that's what they're getting their politicians to move towards. Many of these conversations are being held in secret, and it's quite clear that the reason for that is countries are giving up sovereignty, giving these corporations freedoms that if you were open about it, there would be an upcry against it. I understand all of that. I understand my listeners' interest in it. But you will excuse me if I have a bit of a jaundiced eye about all of this. Corporations are in the business of making money. And when they sit down with their unions, that's what they're doing. And when they sit down with politicians, that's what they're doing. And when they sit down with one another, that's what they're doing. We shouldn't be surprised or amazed that they look for and exploit every opportunity to make more money, higher profits, greater market share, more rapid increase of their company's size, that they take every opportunity to do that. Right now, a bunch of companies around the world see an advantage to getting these 12 nations on the Pacific to write a deal amongst themselves. By the way, there's a bunch of companies that fear they will be hurt if that happens. So what we actually have is a fight between those companies that want to push in the direction of having the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and companies that don't want that to happen. And the reason is simple. The companies pushing it see that they will get gains from it. And the companies opposing it see that they might suffer losses from it. And that kind of struggle between groups of companies is what capitalism always has. What the mass of people ought to be skeptical about is getting very involved in these struggles. Because that's a war between two groups of businesses who have one thing in common. They're trying to make a lot more money, and if they can do that at your expense, they probably will. It would be a far wiser thing for folks in the middle and the bottom, who are, after all, the majority, not to take sides in struggles among different groups of employers, but to rather go about the more urgent business, which is to begin to organize themselves and mobilize themselves so that the needs and interests of middle and lower income people begin to count for something in Washington, in Beijing, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Malaysia, in Japan, etc. That's what's missing. If we don't do that, then the outcomes, whether the capitalists who want the TPP prevail or the capitalists who don't want the TPP to prevail, whichever one of them wins, they're both going to then use whatever they've won or lost to try to make more money save money on paying wages, use technology to replace workers. You know the story because it's been our history. Taking sides in struggles among employers is less of a target and less of a priority than building our own institutions, formulating our own set of needs and desires, and pursuing them rather as the focus for us. Next, let me respond to many of your comments that reacted to something I discussed last week. Last week I pointed out that many states in the United States, and I gave the example of New York with the film Wolf of Wall Street, many states try to win business to their state by offering the companies that come into their state a tax deal, a lower tax rate, a subsidy, some combination of both. And that was done in the case of that film, a 30% cut in the taxes they would otherwise have had to pay. And here's what I pointed out, that the arguments for the state of New York to do that were of two kinds. First, that if the film were shot in New York City, it would mean more hotel guests in New York City, all the personnel, more restaurant meals in New York City, all kinds of money spent by the workers and the actors and the directors of these films, and that meant more business for New York and more jobs for New Yorkers. All of that is true, but that wasn't my point. My point was in the enthusiasm to give these tax breaks to companies, in this case film companies, they also claimed that it wouldn't even cost the taxpayer of New York because all of the extra taxes generated by the extra restaurant meals and hotel stays of the personnel of the film would generate more taxes than they would have gotten if they'd never done it. In other words, the loss of taxes from giving the film company a break would be more than overcome by the extra taxes coming in from all the businesses. And I pointed out, using Professor Karen from Pepperdine University's statistics, that that was not the case, that the state got back only about 30% of the taxes it lost by not taxing that company. And some of you wanted to point out, which I agree with, that nonetheless, having the film made in New York helps people in New York. But here's the bigger point that perhaps I did not explain clearly. Look at it this way. When you give a cut to a film company coming in, what message are you sending? You're sending every film company in New York that's already here a message, hey, you ought to play this game too. Why don't you threaten to make your next film not here in New York where you're based, but in Carolina or in Chicago or in Montana, pick a place, and say if you don't get your way, if you don't get a cut like the company that did Wolf of Wall Street, you're going to leave. Could that happen? Of course it could. How do I know that? Because it already does. In fact, we've had 100 years of experience of companies, all kinds of companies, not just in the film business, doing this every day, going to the local mayor or the local governor and saying, hey, you've got to give me this tax break, tax cut, subsidy, or else I leave. A few weeks ago, I pointed out a recent horrific example, the Boeing Corporation in Washington State, which basically went to that state and said, if you don't give us billions in tax concessions, we're going to go to the Carolinas. And the state of Washington did it, gave them billions. That's money that the state of Washington doesn't have, which means it's got two choices. It either cuts services it provides to people because it no longer has the money to pay for them, or in order to continue providing services, now that they've given a tax break to Boeing, they're going to have to raise the taxes of everybody else. That's the real cost of doing this. And there's an easy solution. Taxes should be collected nationally, a national tax, and then rebated to each of the states and cities as they need it. That way, there's no difference whether you make the film in New York, Chicago, or L.A., or anywhere else. And there's no longer an incentive and no longer a way for the companies to play off the cities and towns against one another. Last response. Some of you have asked me to talk about the minimum wage some more. Okay, here's the debate as it is in the media and in academia. If you raise the minimum wage, you make people pay at least $10.10, say, rather than the current $7.25, will there be some employers who cut workers' jobs because they don't want to pay more than 7.25? The answer is yes, there are some. But you have to weigh that against the following. When you raise the minimum wage, you give all these workers who used to get 7.25 $10.10. They have that much more to spend. They will buy more goods and services, and that will provide more jobs to people. Do you know in advance whether those who lose their job are more numerous than those who will gain a job? The answer is we don't know. And the empirical studies that have been done sometimes show it goes one way, sometimes show it goes the other. But here's the more important point. If you want to do something decent for the scandal of low-wage workers in America, for what the minimum wage is, $7.25 an hour, which means if you work at that level, you're part of the poor in America, then here's what you do. Raise the minimum wage to a decent level so that people have a decent income and can raise their families in a proper way, for God's sake. And if some folks lose their job, here's an easy solution. The government, which should have been doing this anyway, comes in and provides useful work for those people to do, pays them a decent wage too. The numbers are relatively small. It would allow us to do right by the people who work in the private sector and use the public sector to provide for those people that private capitalism is unable to give a job to. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Thank you very much for being with me, and I look forward to meeting with you again over the airwaves next week.
Your time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.